Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Anti-Move Propaganda 2.0. In all my years, I've never seen such biased, negative, and nasty news coverage as I have of the Philadelphia-based MOVE organization. There may be an exception. The coverage of the so-called Central Park Five, the young men charged and later cleared in the rape and beating of a young New Yorker, possibly. But both are test cases in media demonization. They just occurred in different cities. Remember the recent brouhaha over a rock and roll racist who called the president a subhuman? Editorials readily choose such terms to depict MOVE, but they rarely do so these days. They are more sophisticated. Yet demonization remains. This tactic today is used as a pretext and a precursor for war. Remember Saddam Hussein called insane, or Muammar Gaddafi likened to Daffy Duck? This is but the press marching with their ink pens to wars of words. A recent article in the Philadelphia magazine entitled Lost Boy was full of innuendo and suggestion that MOVE folks beat and attack their children. The article, detailing the life and untimely demise of the man once known as Birdie Africa, was at bottom a smear piece on MOVE. Why? Why now? Because MOVE people are up for parole now, for their minimums have all been served. All of the survivors of the police attack on MOVE of August 8, 1978 have spent over 30 years in prison. Now it's time to slime them, according to the press. They do it in a more sophisticated way today, but they do it. They even gratuitously publish bits of letters from MOVE people, which gives illusion of balance. But the slant remains. MOVE is bad. Police, good. How anyone could write about the massacre of May 13, 1985 and not announce that city cops killed 11 men, women, and babies with murderous intent blares the slant of the entire piece. Cops are quoted saying stuff that suggests they never kill kids, as they are killing kids. Former police chief Gregor Sambor told members of the MOVE Commission that children, MOVE children, were considered combatants. Think of that. Combatants. Those children, combatants, were bombed and burned to death for the city of their birth. Yet the slant is a child was forced to eat fruit instead of candy and fresh vegetables instead of Twinkies. Slant. Once again, huh?
May 13th, 1985. Meanings. For years, I've written on the meanings of May 13th, 1985. The murders, the massacre, the bombing, and the burnings of the MOVE organization in Philadelphia. The unjust incarceration of Ramona Africa, and the impunity for killer cops, baby killers in blue, immune from crimes that would make devils blush. 29 years had passed, and except for Ramona, no one ever entered a jail cell. How has this impunity serve the city and the citizens of Philadelphia. Today, cops, in broad daylight, rob people, testify falsely, and plant drugs on people. Recently, a Philadelphia newspaper reported on a squad of cops robbing hundreds of thousands of dollars from local businesses, walking in, tapping the till at gunpoint. State and federal prosecutors turn a blind eye like nothing happened. That's because it's nothing compared to May 13th, 1985. This is the foul fruits of May 13th. Impunity breeds corruption, and the whole city suffers. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, July 26th, 2016. So I have been told. We will be here tomorrow. Pam will be back with us. Always a pleasure to have her on the program. We'll be discussing some of the things that have taken place this summer, suggestions, things black people can and should be doing to help solve problems and make sense of some of the madness of the summer of 2016. That's it. Our broadcast for today, the audio segment that you heard at the beginning of the program, Mumia Abu-Jamal, huge fan of his work. Always appreciate his commentary, and definitely folks should be informed about, concerned about his health. He has not been doing additional commentaries for, I'd say, close to a year now, just because of his health problems. We're going to talk about that today as well. But I know Dr. Kamau Kamban, he says, with the legions of black journalists that we've had over the years, he always points to Mumia Abu-Jamal as the standard bearer in terms of excellence of black journalism. Him talking about the MOVE organization, for folks who listen to this program, we certainly have talked about the importance of MOVE, what happened to them, the bombing of their house, and how they've been portrayed in the media over the last several decades. We had Jason Oster on the program to talk about his documentary film, Let the Fire Burn. Really important event, and even the timing to be talking about this while the Democratic National Convention is happening in Philadelphia. Joining us for the program today, a veteran member of the MOVE organization in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. As you heard from Mumia Abu-Jamal, she is the only person connected with the 1985 bombing of the MOVE house who went to jail. The only person, and unless I have been misinformed, she and Birdie Africa, Michael Ward, they were the only two people who survived who walked out of the residence from May 1985. Real honor to have her on the program just to hear some of her views, her thoughts, recollections on what happened, on what she thinks we should be doing right now to solve some of our problems. Joining us live from Pennsylvania, our guest, Ramona Africa. Ramona Africa, are you with us?
I'm there on the MOVE.
On the MOVE. Good to hear from you. I'm so glad you could share some of your Tuesday evening to speak with us. I guess before we get started, just anything that you would like to share with our listeners, anything that you think is important to touch on before we get started?
Well, since you mentioned that the DNC is here in Philadelphia at this time, I feel encumbered to say that I really, really wish that our people would understand, come to the awareness that politics has never, ever worked for us. It was never designed to work for us, and get in the mode of unity, solidarity, coming together to do for ourselves, because that is the only thing that is going to improve our condition. So I just, I wanted to say that since this is a time of politics and, you know, they're right here in Philadelphia. So.
And before I ask my question, folks can get additional information. You can go to their website, On the Move, onamove.com, onamove.com. It is linked in the description for the program. They have a meeting coming up August 7th, where they will be giving out information on their conference that's coming up the summer of 2017. Check it out. Go to onthemove.com and you will get all the information. You'll see the flyer for the conference that's coming up on Sunday, August 7th, and it's free admission. And then you'll also see information about how you can support and look forward to the conference that's coming up in 2017. You can invest. You'll see the fundraiser button as well. My question was going to be, what would your response be to folks who say, hey, that sort of talk and encouraging black people to not vote in the election and to not participate in politics, that sort of talk is exactly what's going to lead to Donald Trump being elected. And that would be just horrible for black people to have 4 years of him in the White House. How would you respond?
Well, I would agree that having Donald Trump in the White House is horrible, would not be in our interest, but I have not seen any candidates for president or other offices that have really made a difference to poor people of color. You know, I mean, they may not be as overt with their racism and being ineffective in accomplishing things to improve our condition. Well, what have they done? I mean, you got Barack Obama in office, and more particularly black people and people of color have been killed under his regime around the world. And not to mention right here in the United States, you've had more police killings of young black men and women. Obama has a personal friend named Skip Gates, that people recall, a Harvard University professor, law professor. He was accosted, assaulted by cops going into his own house because they didn't believe that was his house. They know black man, excuse the expression, no nigger supposed to have a house like that. So they accosted him, assaulted him, and what did his friend, his personal friend, the President of the United States, who was supposed to be the most powerful, you know, man really in the world as they see it, what did he do for his friend? Invited him and the cop that assaulted him to the White House for beer? That's the best he could do for somebody that he knows personally, cause a personal friend. What do people think he can do or would do for somebody that he doesn't even know? You know, I'm at the point, most people have been at the point where we don't believe in futility. When something has been proven not to work for us, then why keep beating your head against the brick wall? Why not look to self and begin thinking along the lines of getting together and working for ourselves, doing for ourselves? In all of the years of politics, there's no way that people can say, well, you know, we got to have this person and we got to get more blacks in, more women in, you know, more Latinos in. We've had more black elected officials and even Latino officials elected than really ever before in history. But what has that accomplished for us? Because this system is not designed to work for us. You know, in the what do you call it, the legal foundation of this country, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. It says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. You know? And the thing is, who were they talking about? They weren't talking about us. They weren't talking about black people. They weren't talking about indigenous people that they slaughtered into virtual extinction. They weren't talking about women. They weren't even talking about white men that didn't own land. So who were all these people, you know, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights? Who were they talking about? It's a trick. They never meant it. When they use the word equality, that's all it is a word, you know? And they cannot convince who, at least, to close our eyes or act like we're not seeing and experiencing, excuse me, what we're seeing and experiencing, you know? I mean, they tell you, well, when young black people or Latino people, et cetera, are shot down, murdered by police, well, you know, we're going to investigate. Don't condemn all cops for, you know, what a few might do. My position is I want to know where all the so-called good cops are when these things be happening. Where are they? Why aren't they stepping up? Why aren't they speaking up? You know, MOVE cannot be fooled or tricked by the foolishness of those that run this system. And until more people, you know, really acknowledge what they're seeing, what's going on, it's never going to stop. It's never going to stop. I mean, after the bombing of my family that you spoke about, I mean, a bomb was dropped on us by this government. Our babies were burned alive. People were questioning MOVE, questioning us about whether or not we're violent. Now, who did we bomb? Who did we kill? What babies did we burn alive? But people, I'm not even talking about officials, cops, etc. I'm talking about people on the street questioning us about whether or not we're violent and aren't we violent. You know, that's how tricked and confused those running this system have people. And we have to find our way out of that confusion, or else we're doomed. We're doomed.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And I think that shows exactly what Mumia Abu-Jamal, what he was talking about in the introduction piece, how well mm-hmm. the deception has worked in terms of confounding the way that people think about MOVE, thinking that you all are the terrorists when you all were the victims of terrorism being bombed. Just for people, because I'm sure we have a lot of younger folks who, some of them probably right. are not even alive, May 1985, when you all right. were bombed. Just before the bombing, just if you can kind of explain what MOVE was and how you became involved with the organization.
Okay. What was happening before the May 85 bombing of my family is our unrelenting fight for the release of our innocent sisters and brothers known as the MOVE 9, who have been in prison since August of 1978. Unjustly, there is no justification for our family being in prison. And as a note, they are still in prison 38 years later. But our fight, was for the release, is for the release of our innocent family members. And for daring to speak up, for daring to expose, you know, the injustice, racism, you know, directed at MOVE, they determined, officials, they determined that they could not stop us. They tried everything to stop us over the years. Beat us up, locked us up, beat our women into miscarriage, killed our babies, both born and unborn, you know, trampled over a three-week-old MOVE baby. This is what we were going through in the 70s, in the 70s on up. And when MOVE said, hey, we're not accepting that. We are not going to sit back and be beat and brutalized and put in prison for nothing. You know, we're standing up for ourselves. And while people look at what happened and want to point the finger at MOVE and say we brought it on ourselves, that if we hadn't took the stands that we took, that this would not have happened to us, you know, the 1978 attack or the 1985 attack. But that's not true. That is absolutely not true. Because when you look at Freddie Gray, when you look at Amadou Diallo, Michael Brown, you know, even Trayvon Martin, okay, they were not speaking out like MOVE. And I'm not criticizing them. I'm just stating the fact. They didn't speak out like MOVE, you know, but they were victimized by this system nonetheless, you know. So if you're going to be victimized, whether you speak out or not, then why not speak up for yourself, defend yourself? That's what MOVE was doing prior to the bombing, speaking out for our innocent sisters and brothers, you know, who were imprisoned unjustly, given 30 to 100 year sentences. And because we would not shut up, because we would not, you know, be quiet about it and accept what they were doing, that's why they came out to our home and dropped the bomb. They had decided that, well, if we can't control them, if we can't shut them up, make them submit, then hey, we're going to have to get rid of them, going to have to kill them. And this should not be surprising to people, because this is the attitude of officials all around the world, you know? U.S. officials go all over the world, and if they cannot make another country's president, premier, whatever, submit to America's way of doing things, then they will overthrow their government, and if that doesn't work, they will assassinate them. Look what they did to Muammar Gaddafi, you know? And, I mean, you can look at this attitude all over the world when it comes to this country. So, you know, it shouldn't be difficult for people to understand what's happening here, what I'm talking about.
What's your response to people who say, well, with the 1978 raid that ultimately led to the MOVE 9 being incarcerated, as you stated, 38 years, that some of them have been in greater confinement in Pennsylvania, where I'm sure many folks would take the position, well, hey, an enforcement officer, a Philadelphia police officer was shot during the raid, and they attributed this to MOVE, and so that's why they're incarcerated, because of the gun exchange that took place. What would your response be?
Well, my first response is that these officials know clearly. I'm sorry, hold on one second.
Great. Can you check that mailbox?
I'm sorry. The first thing I would say is that these officials know beyond any doubt that MOVE people did not kill Officer James Ram. If they even thought that MOVE people killed James Ram, then why did they demolish MOVE headquarters within hours after my family's arrest? That was the scene of the crime. When do you destroy vital evidence like that, particularly in a police murder, you know, the killing of a policeman? They never would have done that if they thought my family killed James Ram. Secondly, James Ram was shot with the bullet traveling on a downward angle. MOVE people, all MOVE people, even by the police acknowledgments, were all in the basement of our home. James Rant was standing up on street level, when he was shot. So how could they have shot him? How could they have shot him from the basement on a downward angle? Physically impossible. And finally, my family had what's known as a bench trial. That means a trial by jury and not by a judge, okay? So the judge sat through that entire trial. At the end, he convicted 9 of my sisters and brothers, the MOVE 9, of murder, and then sentenced them to 30 to 100 years each in prison. A day or so later, he went on a radio talk show here in Philadelphia, and Mumia Abu-Jamal heard him, so he called in. He asked Judge Malnick one question. Who killed Officer Ram? Judge Malnick said, I haven't the faintest idea. That was his response. Now, if he didn't have the faintest idea, how could he convict my family? Whether you're a judge or a juror, in order to convict somebody, you are supposed to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. Obviously, he wasn't when he said he didn't have the faintest idea, okay? Now, to just step away from that for a minute and talk about the concept of murder and being opposed and outraged by murder. One thing I have noticed over and over and over again when cops kill somebody, you know, the numerous times, the many, too many names of people killed by the cops, where's the outrage there? Where's the outrage? You know, you might hear about it on the news and hear about the cop put behind the desk with pay, you know. But when a cop is killed, oh my God, there's all this outrage. And, you know, journalists will write or say one or two lines and then write, I don't know how many paragraphs or lines about cops being killed. You know, when an unofficial person is killed by cops, oh, it's not that important. It doesn't warrant the outrage. Now, I am not saying that unofficial people, young black men and women, Latino men and women, are more important than cops. But neither am I saying that cops are more important than the people killed by cops. So let's look at this fairly. When a person is accused of killing a cop and end up in jail, why is it always, well, that's why they're in jail. They killed a cop, you know? When are we going to really get outraged and focus on the fact that hardly any cops go to jail or face execution, face the charge of murder when they kill, you know, unofficial people? So...
Context of white supremacy. And just to add in on that, number one, they do have lots of footage, not just of the 1985 bombing of the MOVE residence, but also the confrontation in 1978, where you can see the MOVE members coming out of the basement of the residence, just as you just heard from Ramona Africa. They have lots of footage of that, so you can see that as well. And then the only
other... And the beating of our brother Delbert Africa.
Yes, ma'am.
I mean, they beat him almost to death. He was unarmed, you know, came out the house, and it took them a year, over a year, to even prosecute three of the four cops that beat my brother. You know, and that was after we would not shut up. We would not back down. We kept the pressure on. And the district attorney, who was Ed Rendell at the time, had to do something. He was in a position where he really, you know, had to do something. The three of the four cops, they never prosecuted the fourth cop. They claimed they didn't know who he was. The three cops that went on trial said that they could not get a fair trial with the Philadelphia jury. They went to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to select a jury, brought them into Philadelphia to sit through the trial, and after the prosecution and after the defense had put on their case, the judge, Stanley Kabaki, stepped in, dismissed the jury, thanked them for their service. Now, they done sat through this whole trial away from their families and everything, you know, waiting to render a verdict. He dismissed them and said that there had been too much bloodshed at the hands of MOVE, you know, and that he was going to be the lightning rod to staunch the flow of blood. And he proceeded to acquit the three cops of the charges of, you know, beating my brother. They didn't even charge them with assault. They charged them with official repression, some minor lightweight stuff. And he acquitted them of those charges himself. Didn't even let the jury render their verdict. Now, this is the system that people, you know, poor people, people of color, are being told to accept and endorse. You know, what politicians spoke out about that? Or the attack on my family in 78? Where was the backbone of all these politicians that people go out and elect? You know, when black babies, black children were literally burned alive behind the order of let the fire burn. You know, when have you ever heard of anything like that? And why didn't these elected officials speak out? You know, I don't understand really how anybody can have any faith in politicians. You know, this woman, I was just in the grocery store. In fact, that's where I was when you called me. And this woman asked me, was I Ramona Africa? And I said, yes. And she was saying, you're going to vote, right? Something to that effect. And I was like, no. No, why not? I said, well, if you can tell me what black people have benefited from voting, excuse me, ever since voting, ever since we were able to vote, then maybe I can think about it. I said, but I don't see anything that we've really benefited from all these years of voting. You know, you have more black elected officials, Latino officials, etc. today than ever before. And our condition is worse than ever before. You know? I mean, come on. Every week or so, you're hearing about people being killed by cops. That one in Miami, Florida, with the caretaker for the autistic people. This man was on the ground, on his back, with his hands up, saying, you know, I work for them. This gentleman is autistic. I was trying to calm him down and, you know, trying to explain. The cop shot him three times. Three times. And when the caretaker asked the cop, why did you shoot me? You know what the cop said? He said, I don't know. That's what he said. I don't know. And I mean, come on. How long are we going to be accepting this nonsense while they go crazy when a cop is killed? You know, when they have all kinds of memorials and everything, the president gets up there and says, what, a few words about Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, and a whole long diatribe about the cops that were killed. I mean, how long are people going to accept this nonsense? I can't take it. I'll tell you that. I can't take it. And I cannot, thanks to John Africa opening my eyes, I cannot close my eyes to what I'm seeing. You know, every time the cops kill somebody, it's like, well, you don't know the whole story, you know. You're not really seeing what you're seeing, you know. And I'm like, how many times are they going to run that tired old excuse, you know?
Context of white supremacy, absolutely. For people, and again, you know, a lot of folks just trying to get some of the history out about the MOVE organization. And again, you can go to the website, onthemove.com. onthemove.com, O-N-A, move.com. It's linked in the description. Support. They have a fundraiser going on as well to promote, to take care of the conference that they're going to be conducting in 2017. And again, folks that are in the Pennsylvania area, you can hit the meeting that's coming up August 7th. It is free. Just a couple days from now, they'll be giving out more information on how you can support. For folks who are not...
Want to make it clear to people that the conference that we're doing in May of next year, 2017, we felt obligated to do this conference. We feel like it was long past due because what we're doing at this conference is MOVE is going to tell people, explain to people what our belief really is. Who John Africa is, and why this system wants to kill us all. Journalists, people who think they're experts and know what they're talking about, all kinds of people have taken it upon themselves to tell people who MOVE is and what we believe in. And we feel like it's past time for MOVE ourselves to tell people. It's past time for people to hear about MOVE from MOVE. So that's what that conference is about next year.
Ashe, ashe. I guess to that question specifically, I wanted to ask because we've had quite a few people on the program who have done work on you. Exactly as you said, other people coming in to tell the world, this is MOVE. I've done the research and this is what MOVE was about, and particularly a lot of white people. We had Jason Osder. He did the documentary Let the Fire Burn, which debuted on.
And he interviewed me in depth several times and never used one bit of that interview. Or he said he interviewed a lot of other people, never used any of the interviews in that movie.
Wow. He said when we had him on the program in 2014, it was just, I think, a week or so after the film debuted on PBS. He said he also spoke with Mumia Abu-Jamal as well in prepping for the to get his documentary together. There's no footage of Mumia Abu-Jamal in the film either. It does have exclusively archival footage. I don't think there's anything that's new.
Well, he was playing it safe. Hmm. You know, I understand exactly what was happening. He's not young, but fairly young, and trying to break into the film industry. He's not trying to make any enemies, you know. So he was taking what he saw as the safe course, you know, the safe course, just using archival footage that wasn't real indicting. Some of it was, you know. I can't say none of it was. But that was his position, and I know it.
Just within the past couple of weeks, we had Melissa Stein on the program. This is a white woman. She said,
"Oh yeah, I know her."
She said she did. She said she was. That's her next project is on the MOVE organization. Has she come to interview you as well?
Did she interview? I don't think she interviewed me. She had me by speakerphone address their class, and. We talked, we actually met at Temple University. I was there with another professor that teaches at Kutztown University here in Pennsylvania. And Melissa was there, and she saw me, and she approached me, and I talked with her, and she even tried to get me out to Kentucky where she teaches to do, you know, a lecture. It didn't work out at the time, not because of her, because of me. Some family emergencies came up, and I just couldn't go. But, we have talked, and she has talked to me. I gave her a lot of information. I know her.
And she said that that's the next project that she's working on. And I know when she was with us just a few weeks back, she was talking specifically about the use of the term terrorism, that was something that she a major part of her project in terms of you all being branded a terrorist organization and the bombing of your house not being thought of as an act of terrorism, state-sanctioned terrorism, no less.
Whatever the state does is okay. That's never terrorism or wrong or anything.
We also had John Patash on the program as well, twice, in fact. We talked about his book, The FBI War Against Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, and then his more recent book. I know you were included in that book as well, where he talks about what happened to the MOVE organization. What were your thoughts on Mr. Patash's work?
Well, I have to tell you honestly, I have not read it. But I do know that he has been pretty sympathetic, and by that I mean honest and, you know, really good about putting out the truth. So, like I said, I haven't read it, so I really can't, you know, critique it. But I'm fairly sure that he gave an accurate accounting and, you know, spoke out the way he or anybody else should speak out about what happened to my family. You know, I have filed a civil suit after the bombing, after it became very clear that not one single official was being held accountable for the murder of my family or any crimes that occurred in May of 85. So I filed a civil lawsuit. And when I was on stand, on the witness stand, I can't remember exactly what I was saying at the time, but I do remember that it was very clear that MOVE does not believe in this system, in its legality. John Africa had taught us that legal, that concept of legality is just a concept of those who run the system, in the interest of those who run the system, and that legal has never been synonymous or meant the same as right. And John Africa pointed to slavery being legal, the Holocaust being legal, the apartheid government of South Africa being legal. And these things were not right. None of them, but they were illegal. So MOVE is never concerned with the concept of legality. We are concerned with what is right. And that's what everybody should be concerned with. And anybody that tries to tell you, tries to convince you that, first of all, you have no right to defend yourself when you're threatened, when you're wronged, anybody that tries to convince you that this system is working and that you should have faith in it and conduct yourself according to it, they are not your friend. They're your enemy. They're your enemy. You know? Mm-hmm. People better really start loving themselves enough to be protected of themselves and not just allow those running this system to do anything to them or to their family. I mean, come on. You know, when I was on that stand, this is the kind of information and attitude that I had, kind of information I was putting out and the kind of attitude I had. And the attorney for the police commissioner, Gregory Sambor, he said to me, "So, you don't believe in this system, right? You feel like you have the right to, like, I forgot the word he used, like, go against it, stand up to it, confront it, oppose it." And I was like, "Absolutely." I said, "If you're," because this was like an English guy, I was like, "If your ancestors had the attitude that you would like MOVE to take going along with the program," I said, "you'd still be speaking the King's English." I said, "But people in England rebelled against that, came to the United States, and every year you celebrate them as heroes, freedom fighters, you know? Every 4th of July, their names ring out. So what makes Patrick Henry, Paul Revere, Nathan Hale, George Washington freedom fighters for standing up for what's right and going to war with King George of England, and makes a Leonard Peltier, a MOVE 9, a Mumia Abu-Jamal, a Oscar Lopez Rivera, a, you know, Dr. Mutulu Shakur, Sundiata Okoli, makes these people urban terrorists? Based on what? You know, either it's right to confront and oppose wrong injustices, or it's not. You cannot celebrate it and condemn it at the same time. He was so, like, flustered, he asked for a recess. Yeah, he asked for a recess.
Wow. context of...
That is the power of the wisdom of John Africa. It's undisputable. You know? It's undisputable.
Context of white supremacy. And you represented yourself. You were charged with riot and conspiracy
yes.
after the bombing mm-hmm. of the MOVE residence in 1985. And you represented yourself, mm-hmm. correct?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
Yes, I did. My family, the MOVE 9, represented themselves. And I know that some people will look at that and their sentence, 30 to 100 years, and look at the fact that I was convicted and spent 7 years in prison, which, by the way, the parole board at my 16-month minimum told me that they would parole me, but only if I agreed to sever all ties with MOVE, you know, not have any contact with any MOVE person. Which they not only told me that, they told several of my sisters and brothers that who had come up for parole. Not a one of us accepted that nonsense. Who want to tell me that I can't associate with my family? There are MOVE people that do not have a police record. You know, there are MOVE people that they tried to push that, quote, special condition on, that have children, have spouses, mates, and MOVE. What are you telling us? We can't associate with our children, with our mate? Come on. Do you tell Christians, Muslims, Jewish people that, you know, get arrested for something, that as a condition of their parole, they can't associate with Christians, Muslims, other Jews? No. So where do they think they're going to get off telling us? It was just another tactic to try to break up this organization.
Mm. More recently, I just saw MOVE in the newspaper, national publications, with the incident that happened in Dallas, where you've been talking about these enforcement officers being shot and killed, where they had the five officers reportedly shot, the alleged gunman, Micah Xavier Johnson. They reported that they used a robot to detonate an incendiary device to kill
C4.
Him.
C4.
I'm sorry?
C4.
Oh, yeah.
C4.
Right.
The same explosives that they use on us.
Exact. That's exactly the comparison. They said that many reports that I saw, it wasn't just one time, but many mainstream national reports, they said that they think this is unprecedented in the history of U.S. policing and using a robot drone, if you will, to deliver
mm-hmm.
some sort of
mm-hmm.
explosive device to neutralize a suspect. And they said the only thing that they can even think of that's kind of close is what happened to the MOVE organization in 1985. Just what do you think about that comparison and what took place with this event?
I think it's a very accurate comparison. And I also want to point out that they wanted to kill Micah Xavier Johnson. They wanted to kill him. They didn't want to arrest him. Same thing with MOVE. They didn't want to arrest us. They wanted to kill every living being in that house, in our house. And the proof of them wanting to kill Johnson, Micah Xavier Johnson, is that if they could send a robot in there with C4, a powerful military incendiary device, why couldn't they have put some kind of gas in there to knock him out? Why couldn't they do that? They didn't have to kill him. They wanted to kill him. Yeah. Mm.
This sort of tactic being used, do you have any sense that there could be an escalation of this sort of tactic being used against black people, particularly black people that are saying they're trying to do something
mm-hmm.
about racism, white supremacy, and how black people mm-hmm. have been abused and mistreated? Do you see an escalation in this sort of tactic?
Absolutely, Gus. MOVE told people way back in 1985 and even before that, that if they sit back in silence against what they see happening to MOVE, that they were endorsing their own demise, because it's not about MOVE, whether you agree with MOVE or not, or not. MOVE doesn't endorse killing. You know, we're not saying hallelujah or celebrating the death of those cops in Dallas or in Baton Rouge. But what we are saying is people have to take a stand against injustice, against wrong, against racism, inequality, no matter who the victim is. You know? And people did not do that. And unfortunately, the large reason for that, one of the large reasons for that, is at the time, Philadelphia had its first black mayor. And while in 1978, when Frank Rizzo, known racist, attacked MOVE people, no MOVE people were killed in August of 78. Not a one, okay? One cop was killed. No MOVE people were killed. Yet, the people of Philadelphia really responding to the notorious Frank L. Rizzo, known racist, brutal cop who became a cop-loving, brutal police chief and ended up becoming mayor. People were responding to his madness, and black, white, old, young, male, female, took to the streets, marched on City Hall, saying, four more years, hell no, Madman Rizzo's got to go. Now, no MOVE people were killed in this attack on MOVE, all right? Fast forward to 85 with the first black mayor and a bomb being dropped and 11 innocent, and I say innocent even by system standards, because you're supposed to be innocent till proven guilty, and MOVE people had not been proven guilty of anything in May of 85. Where was the outrage? Why didn't people take to the streets with babies being burned alive? You know what? Their resounding phrase was, we have to support our first black mayor. I thought I would lose my mind when I heard that. You know, so the lives of innocent black people, you know, what were we accused of, Gus? Raping, robbing, murdering, molesting children, drug trafficking. None of that. None of that. They came out there with a warrant that said disorderly conduct, terroristic threats, which was a lie. We didn't threaten nobody. But nevertheless, that's what they came out there with. And you're telling me that those charges warranted 10,000 rounds of bullets, tear gas, 40,000 pounds of water pressure per minute being pumped in our house by the fire department, firefighters? When did they become, you know, criminologists getting involved in criminal charges, you know? And the thing is, after I went to court, they had to drop the charges listed in the warrants that they came out there with, the disorderly conduct and the terroristic threat. They had to drop those charges as invalid and having no basis to them, which means that they had no legitimate reason for being out there. But they would not drop the charges that they put on me that resulted in what happened after they came out there. They did not drop those charges. But if their reason for being there was invalid, anything coming from that has to be invalid. You know? These are the games that these people run on the masses. And while they're a problem, the real problem is the masses accepting this nonsense. You know? I mean, come on. I know people will look, at MOVE and say, MOVE people have spent 38 years so far in prison. You had a bomb dropped on you. 11 of your family members were murdered, you know. We can understand people being a bit intimidated by that. Hell, I was there. And there is no way I'm going to sit back and say everything was cool. I was cool. I wasn't scared. I wasn't frightened. I wasn't terrified. You're doggone right I was terrified. Because I was experiencing terrorism. Anybody that says they're unaffected by such actions, that they weren't frightened and terrified, they're either crazy or they're lying, you know, or something wrong with them, yeah, you know. But the thing is, Gus, look at it this way. You can list, the list can be endless, I should say, of people who weren't confronting this government about anything, who weren't taking a stand about anything, and ended up victimized by this system nonetheless. Look at Trayvon Martin. He wasn't confronting anything. Look at Amadou Diallo in New York. He's standing in front of his building where he lived. You know? And I mean, the list can go on. Ramsey Orta in New York, who filmed the murder of Eric Garner. He wasn't like standing up or anything. He had his camera or phone, whatever, and filmed it. They came after him. You know? Put made up, trumped up charges on him. He's getting ready to do some jail time, from the last I heard.
Yep.
For nothing. You know? And the list goes on of people. Ray Seals, or was it the cousin? Was Ray Seals the football player? Yeah, he was the football player, but his cousin, who was a businessman, minding his business, paying his bills, you know, going along with this system, basically, got stopped by cops and ended up being killed by cops. He wasn't at a demonstration. He wasn't confronting anybody. So if you're going to be victimized or even killed, whether you're standing up or not, wouldn't you rather go down fighting? What's that old adage? I'd rather die on my feet than be living on my knees.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I just, you know, I don't know what to say. I'm just really hoping that people hear what's being said here and think about it and start doing something, standing up for themselves. Not for MOVE, not for Leonard Peltier or Oscar Lopez Rivera or Dr. Matulu Shakur, you know, but for themselves, for their family. You know, for their families, because you don't want to wait until your husband, your wife, you know, on a Sandra Blaine kind of thing, or your children, your son, your daughter, like Tamir Rice, you know, end up being killed at the hands of this system by cop or otherwise, or George Zimmerman or whoever. Before you get it, you know, before you get it, prevention is the key. And the way to stop these things from happening and prevent them from happening again is to stand up, fight back, you know, Be serious. Be committed about putting an end to this madness.
Shame. I have been to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm speaking to you today from Washington State, but I have been to the city of
Brotherhood. I love Washington State.
It's awesome.
I love Washington. I've been there. I love Olympia.
We're missing all of the heat. It was 76 degrees today. Lovely day. They have, or at least when I was there, Sylvester Stallone, as the character of Rocky, was not the only person who had a statue. Frank Rizzo had a statue in the middle of Philadelphia. Is that statue still there?
In front of the Municipal Services Building.
Wow.
And it's still standing, unmarred, you know.
Wow. I have said before, in this system, they frequently make monuments and what have you to individuals who notoriously have terrorized black people. When they did all that talking about taking down the Confederate flag and what have you, I said they did not take down Ben Tillman statues in South Carolina. Frank Rizzo statue still gleaming in the city of brotherly love as the Democratic National Convention goes on. You all also... dedicate a sizable amount of time and energy also making sure that people are informed about the deteriorating health of Mumia Abu-Jamal. He spent many years on death row. He's still in greater confinement, although not on death row currently. Just can you kind of give folks an update on his health status?
Oh, yeah. It's not good. It goes up and down, like sometimes he has these breakouts where his skin like blisters or turns black and just itches him uncontrollably. The thing that people should understand is that it is the intent of those running this system to kill Mumia. They couldn't do it legally through execution, you know? So now they're trying to do it, I don't say through medical neglect, but through medical reasons, you know, through medical concepts or whatever, because it's not neglect. They are actively killing Mumia. There was a three-day hearing in December 18th, 21st and 22nd in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Large numbers of people traveled up to Scranton for the hearing. The judge granted the hearing as an emergency, you know, as Mumia's health status being an emergency situation. Taking that into consideration, wouldn't you think that when the hearing was over, that he would make his ruling fairly quickly? That was in December, Gus. He still has not made a ruling.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So when I tell you their intent is to kill Mumia, it most certainly is. There is no reason in the world why that judge, who said it was an emergency situation and granted those 3 days of hearings, and the things that came out during those 3 days of hearings showed how the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections lied, schemed. I mean, this came out during the hearing. Now, with the information on Mumia's deteriorating health and the lies and schemes that the Department of Correction used, wouldn't you think this judge would have been made a decision here? And the thing is, at this point, even if he so-called rules in Mumia's favor and says that the Department of Correction has to give Mumia the cure for his hepatitis. See, you might have seen commercials for Hervani. That's the cure, literal cure, that has proven to cure hepatitis in many, many people. even if the judge issued a ruling today at this late date saying that they had to provide this form of mail, the thing is, the reality is, the Department of Corrections would appeal. They would appeal it, which means you're dragging out more time in the courts. Mumia wouldn't get the Hervani tomorrow, you know? So it's a really bad situation, and people need to take it very seriously.
Context of white supremacy. We just read medical apartheid. That was a major chunk of what Harriet Washington talked about, the deliberate abuse of black inmates, particularly, again, if you are a black person like Mumia Abu-Jamal, who has dedicated decades of his time and energy, mm-hmm. former member of the Black Panther Party as well, to talking about and trying to do everything he can to solve this problem of white supremacy, racism. We had a couple folks who dialed in with questions. Is it okay to see if we can get a couple questions from our callers?
Yeah, but I'm going to have to go in about 10 minutes, so I can take some questions, yeah.
Okay, folks, dial in promptly. Don't lollygag. The address again, onthemove.com. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Ramona Africa, MOVE veteran?
Yes, I do. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, good evening, guys. Good evening, Mr. Ramona Africa. Harriet
Slade.
Yes, ma'am. My question for you is, and I was learning from the tax, or the so-called tax in Dallas, do you think that maybe this was all set up for hoax? And I mean, my line, I think...
Hello?
Oh, his question. He said the shootings of these reported shootings of the police officers in Dallas, do you think that it could be a hoax? That was his question.
No, I don't think it was a hoax. I do believe that it's possible that it was set up by this system to implement certain attitudes and procedures that they want to justify implementing. I'm not convinced about 911. I'm not convinced that this government didn't set up certain things. You know, you can always, should always be suspect of this government and those who run it and are participants in it.
Okay. Our female caller in New York, did you have a question for Ramona Africa? You should be with us.
Yes, I do. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Miss Africa.
On the move.
On the move. Yes, ma'am. It's been my observation that any time black people do anything constructive in the area of organizing to fight racism, white supremacy, that the system uses white people, injects them into whatever organization that may be, either their ideologies, the people themselves, and their money, in order to dismantle it or thwart mm-hmm. the efforts. And I did see in the documentary, Let the Fire Burn, at least one white person, and I could be mm-hmm. in error, accepted into mm-hmm. the family. I would like to know, at any point, was she considered a suspect at any point during or after this terroristic act was implemented on the MOVE organization?
You're talking about the bombing?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Sue Africa is one of the earliest members of MOVE, and has really caught more hell, or at least as much, if not more, than, you know, our African-American, our Latino sisters and brothers. And she has set an example of loyalty and commitment in this organization. She has literally been through hell. Her son was killed in that bombing, her only son. Sue was in jail with my other sisters and brothers at the time of the bombing. And so she wasn't suspect, you know, at all. I mean, we know Sue Africa. And just, you know, to put this out there, they don't have to use white people to, you know, infiltrate or come into black organizations. Look what Wilson Good did. He wasn't white. You know, he was not white. There's the Black Legislative Caucus in Washington, D.C., and a resolution was introduced calling for Assata Shakur to be extradited back to the U.S. from Cuba. Don't you know that the Black Legislative Caucus members, a lot of them signed it, Maxine Waters, Bobby Rush, a former Panther, you know, and other members of the Black Legislative Caucus. And when confronted about it, how could they sign something like that? Their response was, well, oh, I didn't read the whole thing, or I didn't know Joanne Chesimard was Assata Shakur. That's a lie. But okay, I'll accept that. You didn't know. Why the hell didn't you know? How could you not know? You know? So they don't have to infiltrate with white people. There's quite a number of black people that are ready and willing to, you know, come into black organizations and, you know, do the system's dirt for them. The only thing you can ever go by is not color, but watching people, seeing the example that they set. That's the only thing you can go by. Because a phony, a fake, cannot keep up the pretense forever. It will break. That pretense will fall. It will fall apart. So, yeah, that's
thank
what
you
we
for answering.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Thank you for answering my question. Have a good evening.
Mm-hmm. You're very welcome. You too.
For sure. We have last couple of minutes. If I see a caller, I'll get their hand. I did have two other questions I wanted to ask as well. The first one, Michael Ward, a.k.a. Birdie Africa. He was 13 at the time of the MOVE bombing. He died tragically at the young age of 41, just within the last couple of years. Do you have any thoughts in terms of how the terrorism he experienced as a child member of MOVE at that time, how that might have contributed to his death at the age of 41?
Well, what I can tell you is that after the bombing, the government would not turn him back over to MOVE. They dug his father out of the woodwork, his biological father, Andino Ward, and they didn't have to do much convincing to get Andino to take custody of Birdie, not because Andino had any feelings for Birdie, because Andino and Birdie's mother, Rhonda, they were married when they had Birdie, and they divorced when Birdie was an infant. He was a really young baby. And Andino had made no contact with Rhonda or Birdie since Birdie was an infant baby. There had been, well, let's go back to the 78 confrontation. And then in 85, it was fairly quiet, you know, right around May 13th of 85. But prior to that, there had been situations, you know, with the cops. And Dino never, ever came out there to inquire about his son, you know. on Mother's Day, Sunday, May 12th of 85, which is when the cops first came out there, it was all on the news that the cops were out there. They were planning to take action against me. And Dino never came out there and said, you know, I want my son, I want him out of this situation or anything like that. So the courts turned Birdie over to Andino because they were definitely not going to return Birdie to us. And Birdie, well, let me say this first. Andino took custody of Birdie because he saw dollar signs. He knew that Birdie had a lawsuit, a great lawsuit to file against this system. And he was expecting to get big money. And Birdie did get a big settlement. But anyway, Birdie suffered the traumatic loss of his mother. His mother, Rhonda, was killed in the bombing. He was forced to go live with a man that he did not know and who didn't know him. There were Reader's Digest articles, other like newspaper articles about Andino getting Birdie a bike, taking him to McDonald's, wouldn't let him eat no raw food at all, not a raw onion, raw potato, or anything, because he didn't want any memories of Move, anything that resembled Move, because he hated Move. Andino hated Move. He bought him a bike as if a bike could replace losing his mother, you know? Birdie physically fought him, according to these reports, Reader's Digest and other newspaper reports, physically fought him trying to get out of the house, saying he was going back to Move. Andino encouraged Birdie into the military. He was stationed over in Germany for a while, I understand. One of Birdie's aunts called me back in like 95, 96, something like that, and told me that the military had provided counselors and psychiatrist or whatever for Birdie because he, you know, he was having some issues. And she said he kept asking her about me. How was I doing? Had she seen me? You know, had she heard anything about me? And I told her to tell Birdie to call me or get in touch, you know, somehow, that he knows that Move loves him and would love to hear from him, you know. Of course, I never heard from him. I don't know why. I can't say that it wasn't his own decision of his own choosing. I also can't say that he might have been under a lot of pressure, you know, not to contact Move people. I don't know. All I know is that I did not hear from him.
Wow.
He drowned in a hot tub, you know, on that cruise ship.
Mm-hmm.
Birdie was one of the best swimmers as a child. You can stand up in a hot tub. I just don't get how he drowned in a hot tub.
The Washington Post and some other outlets, they said that there was alcohol in his system at the time that he passed. Is that seem logical to you or no?
No. Even Andino. Now, he could be lying. I don't know because, I mean, Birdie was out there, you know, outside of Move for years, decades, okay? So, I don't know. But Andino said Birdie didn't do any drugs and didn't drink. Now, that's what Andino said.
Huh.
I don't know. Something just sounds really wrong.
Mm. Before we let you go, I just wanted to ask, since, as you stated, there have been a lot of white people, probably more coming, and others who have come to write books or produce films on MOVE to say that they are the experts on your organization. Certainly, I would encourage people to go to the conference. You can get the information at onthemove.com, onthemove.com for the conference coming up next year, 2017. But what else, what sources would you recommend people to check out if they want to get more information about the MOVE organization?
I think they need to contact MOVE personally. We don't hide. We don't make ourselves unavailable to people. Our phone number is out there, 215-386-1165. Our email address is out there, onamove, onamovellja, for Long Live Giant Africa, at gmail.com. Contact MOVE personally. I can email people information that want it. I will talk to people, you know, for as long as I have time on the phone to talk to them. Just don't accept or only look to Wikipedia or, you know, things you might see on the internet, you know, or when you Google MOVE. Don't just accept that. I understand that one of the first rules of journalism is, whenever possible, go to the source. People need to implement that concept. Yeah.
Onthemove.com, the address again, onthemove.com. They are fundraising. Support the conference coming up for 2017, where you can get direct information about what MOVE is all about. Members will be there. Again, that is coming up in 2017. If you're in the Pennsylvania area, you can go to the meeting that's coming up on Sunday, August 7th, where you can get more details about how you can support the conference and things that they'll be doing to organize and prepare for that. Again, that's coming up just in a matter of days, literally, Sunday, August 7th, and that is free. There's more information at onthemove.com, onthemove.com. Thoroughly enjoyed having you on the program. Just a privilege. I'm just been really influenced by reading and learning more about the MOVE organization to help my understanding of the war that's being waged against us, and just really, really appreciated you sharing some of your time to come and speak with us this evening.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to address your listening audience. It's a two-way street, you know. We want information out there. We want people to know about MOVE. And if you feel so inclined to have a MOVE person on, you're giving us the opportunity to do that. So we appreciate that too.
Absolutely. We will definitely continue to get the word out there and encourage folks to support your fundraising efforts. And we have listeners that are in the Pennsylvania area to go out and support and participate in person at the conferences and workshops, things that you're doing. And if there's anything that we can do to help in that regard, let us know. We would love to help out, and just wish you the best in continuing your outstanding work. And just drop us a line if we can help.
Okay, I appreciate that. Let me just close by saying, on the MOVE, long live the MOVE 9, long live Mumia Abu-Jamal, Leonard Peltier, Oscar Lopez Rivera, Sundiata Akoli, Dr. Mutulu Shakur, the Zapatistas, the Puerto Rican Independistas, those indigenous grandmothers at Black Mountain in, I believe it's Arizona, who are fighting for their existence. Long live all those that fight for freedom, that love life enough to fight for it. Long live Earth First, the Earth Liberation Front, the Animal Liberation Front. Long live the spirit of resistance. Long live revolution. Long live Giant Africa. And down with this rotten system. On the MOVE.
On the MOVE, Ramona Africa.
Okay.
Enjoy the rest of your evening. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Good evening. Okay. Context of white supremacy. Wow. I had, was reflecting, just preparing for the program this evening, the amount of just material that I had looked at over the years concerning MOVE. And even when I first heard of the MOVE organization, because, you know, I was not an older person when all this went down in 85, when the bombing of their house. But I think that was one of the first things that I read when I was starting to take racism more seriously and trying to figure out what is racism, white supremacy, how does it work? And I remember I read Let It Burn, the Philadelphia tragedy, Michael Boyette, Randy Boyette. These are two suspected racist authors. But I read that. It had lots of photographs in it. And I mean, it was just stunning to see this, that they bombed this residence. Nothing done about it. No crime. In fact, we're going to lock up some of the people that we bombed. Ramona Africa. It was just stunning to read about that. And then further information and reading about Mumia Abu-Jamal, like, that certainly had a sizable impact on my understanding of racism, white supremacy, and kind of pushing me to use as much of my time and energy as possible towards solving this problem. But definitely, and even while preparing and while listening to Ramona Africa this evening, Mumia Abu-Jamal also had a huge impact, unless I'm misinformed. I don't think he was directly a member of MOVE, but he certainly has been a huge supporter over the years and getting out information about the organization and making sure that people don't forget about what happened to them and their continuing efforts, the MOVE Non still in greater confinement. But Mumia Abu-Jamal also had just a huge impact and continues, has for years had a huge impact. I think Live from Death Row was one of the books that I read in my earlier stage of getting a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, and taking this problem seriously. Death Blossoms, that was another. All Things Censored, that was another. All these are books written by Mumia Abu-Jamal. But reading a lot of his material, and then certainly being able to hear the podcast that he did while he was in greater confinement, which is stunning for many reasons, which was just another element that just infuriated whites, and they were trying to shut this down. And in my view, I think Ramona Africa kind of confirmed the deliberate effort to destroy his health, in my view, directly related to, this is one way that we can shut that down so we don't have to hear him talking anymore, and for people to get further information, accurate information about things, for him to continue his efforts as a black journalist talking about the system of white supremacy. We'll just figure out another way to neutralize that. But huge impact Mumia Abu-Jamal has had on my understanding of racism, white supremacy, and that's definitely a failure. I'd have to stand up and say we definitely should have been doing a lot more in terms of focusing on the serious health problems that he's been having, because that's just another aspect of racism, white supremacy. We just spent all those months in medical apartheid talking about that is standard operating procedure to go after black people once they are in greater confinement, out of public view, and just doing all kinds of things to their spiritual, mental, physical well-being once they have you in greater confinement. But that is certainly something that we definitely should have focused much more attention on. I know we played a lot of his podcast segments over the years from him being in greater confinement and different things that he touched on, different things that he talked about relating to racism, white supremacy. And I have that has been a huge void for me, not hearing his assessment. That was something that I always was just in awe of, for him to be in greater confinement and not the best health. He seemed like someone who spent a lot of time making sure that he was informed, just accessing as much information as possible in an environment where they are actively looking to keep him from being informed. He seemed to win that battle on a regular basis. I mean, he would have global perspective on things, and I mean live time to be able to give commentary right as things are evolving. I'm talking about somebody who did commentary about Daniel Holdsclaw. How many mainstream outlets didn't even talk about Daniel Holdsclaw, where he had segments on that, Tamir Rice, the situation in Ferguson, just global perspective. It is absolutely amazing. I would certainly put him up with anybody in terms of just an outstanding illustration, in my view, of black self-respect, and someone who understood the importance of being informed locally, nationally, globally, and the threat that that represents to the system of white supremacy, even in greater confinement and in poor health, that still represented a problem that racists wanted to take care of. Anywho, folks have commentary that they would like to share about what they heard from Ramona Africa. We can certainly make time for that. I will get the phone lines. I'm just going to take a pause because I had a segment from the documentary that Jason Osgood did. I was very pleased to hear some of her thoughts about these whites coming to interview them and do all these different projects. In my view, that's another way that whites, they practice racism, white supremacy, to come in and be the experts, so that when you go to get information about MOVE, you will not contact Ramona Africa first, or any of the other members of the MOVE organization. You will go to Jason Osgood. You'll go to someone like that and say, oh, this is the expert on MOVE. We'll go see what he has to say about all of this, to see what he has to say about the MOVE organization. But that, fascinating that he went and talked to her and did all these interviews and spent all this time and then included none of that in the film. I would probably be willing to wager I'd probably be willing to wager a sizable figure that Melissa Stein, suspected white supremacist, who was a guest on this program earlier this year, probably is going to listen to this program. I'd be willing to put some money down on that. Folks have any comments and or questions they would like to share about what they heard from Ramona Africa, feel free. The folks that already dialed in who have a hand up, feel free if you have any questions, observations, anything stood out. Man, I know one thing that I hadn't even thought. I would love to have Sue Africa on the program. That is the white member of MOVE. If you see the documentary, Let the Fire Burn, that Jason Osgood did, if you see it, you'll see Sue Africa in that documentary. And I think if you see some of the other photographs of the organization from the 70s and 80s, you'll see her. Man, I would love, love, love to have her as a guest on the program. What exactly she's doing now, what she has been doing. I might have to drop Ramona Africa an email about that to see if that is a possibility. That would be a hoot to hear her perspective and ask her a few questions. Anywho, folks that dialed in who have a hand up, I'll get a retired firefighter first. He even jogged my memory. That, I think, is huge. The footage where they go and they did a big investigation and spent all this money and cut down a whole forest worth of trees to do this big report about what happened and why this house. And it was not just this house. I meant to say that while Ramona Africa was here, it was not just the MOVE house that was bombed. 11 fatalities. It was an entire neighborhood that was burned to the ground. Over 60 black-owned homes. This was not a what you call quote-unquote gentrified neighborhood. This was not what they call quote-unquote people of color. This was exclusive black-owned houses, over 60 of them, and they burned all of them to the ground. That being said, that, I think, is huge. And when they interviewed the folks at the fire department, retired firefighter, jog my memory, when they interviewed the white person at the fire department and they said, why didn't you put the fire out? You're there. The fire department is here. They had been using a deluge gun and pumping all these gallons of water on the house, trying to get these black residents, the MOVE members, out of the house. Why didn't you put the fire out instead of, you know, letting it burn down the whole neighborhood? And he said, well, you know, the enforcement officers, they didn't tell me to put the fire out. And he says, so is the protocol your normal protocol? You need someone to give you permission to put out a fire? And he says, no. They said, I don't understand. Why did you put the fire out? You just sat there and with the equipment there, you just sat there and let the whole neighborhood burn down? And I never heard an adequate response to that question as to why they let the fire earn. That is the system of white supremacy. Retired firefighter, did you have commentary that you wanted to get in about anything that you heard from Ramona Africa? Not hearing anything. I don't know if you muted your line or if you're just listening, not hearing anything.
Oh, I had it muted by mistake, and I'm busy running my mouth. I listened to about half of the program. I heard Miss Ramona Africa. I believe she was on your program before. Is that correct? Because if so, I was listening to it that prior time also, and I would have liked to if I was able to talk to her. I would have liked to have acknowledged her and their refusal to be heard. Well, their consistency anyway, their stubbornness, their righteous stubbornness to be heard. And she was correct when she did say that, because they were determined they were going to be heard. You weren't going to shut them up, quote unquote, which is a word that often is a discourteous word that is often used by white people, and something that shouldn't be used by non-white people. Shut up, you know, that sort of thing. But they were determined that they were going to be heard. What I would have liked to got her take on her analysis of the other non-white people, non-white black people who are victims of racist white supremacy, who are not members of the MOVE organization. I thought that they may have underestimated the global system of racist white supremacy, because from my memory of viewing the various documentaries, especially after they had interviewed several of the past residents, they were kind of shocked. They, because some of them actually called 911 over the course of time on the MOVE members also. They were assuming that the power of white supremacy would basically overlook them, or kind of like make some kind of surgical move to make sure that they're not harmed into getting to the MOVE organization. I would assume. I just would have liked to heard her take on that. Of course, we know that the power of white supremacy did not care whether you was a part of MOVE or not. Their whole intent was to bomb the entire block, as we know. And I just wanted to here, let her talk and on her take on that whole scenario, on whether or not, you know, did she think that the other non-white black people who are residents of the area would be assuming that they were not going to get harmed in the situation also, and they were very much harmed. A lot of people lost their personal property, and there's some things, you know, one would say, well, okay, well, with insurance, you know, I can get stuff back and whatever, but there's some personal things that can get harmed in a fire that you can never get back, you know, that you can never get back how the way you want it. So, and from my memory of those documentaries, that was expressed also. And, just would have liked to have heard her take on that whole situation. And that's something that we need to improve on, into not assuming that white people are going to care on whether or not you're part of an organization or not. When they come after us, they don't care whether you are the quote-unquote right one or the wrong one. they're going to harm you anyway because of you are a non-white black person. That's what I would have liked to got a take on that. Thank you.
Mm. I think they say any nigger will do. And
mm-hmm.
that strategy should be kept in mind. That white supremacist strategy should be kept in mind. I think sometimes they use the term collateral damage. That is employed all the time, and I think that's going to be employed now with all of the increased talk of, well, Black Lives Matter should be labeled a terrorist organization. That's just going to mean any, all black people, particularly if you look like you might be saying something about racism, especially you, but that's just going to spread, if it has not already, to any, all black people. Doesn't matter if you are affiliated with or member officially or what have you of quote unquote Black Lives Matter, just any and all black person could be a suspect. We should be paying attention for unjust purposes. We should be paying attention to you. I think that's going to be employed right now, 2016. Thomas in New York, the black female caller in New York, did either of you have comments on what you heard from Ramona Africa that you wanted to get in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Something that she said that I thought was very, it was profound, but it kind of reminded me of Dr. Cambon and Dr. Welsing. I mean, it's like, it was really profound. It kind of gave me something to think about. We should all be thinking about this all the time, is what I'm really trying to say. She said something about us loving ourselves. And I could always remember Dr. Welsing expounding on black self-respect and loving ourselves, Dr. Cambon as well, and the things that we would do and the things that we would not do if we really, you know, just sat down for a moment and understood that, what that really entails, loving yourself. A lot of us say that we love ourselves, but look at the system that we're in, that we're all victims of. And I thought that was really, 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 really profound when she said that. It kind of like raised my vibration level when she said it, because I thought of Dr. Welsing and Dr. Cambon when she said that. But that's all I needed to say. I'll mute my line.
Dr. Welsing's sister, Lauren Kress-Love, she said that a lot, the three times that she's been with us this year since Dr. Welsing's passing, about the importance of us loving ourselves. I thought of her immediately when she said that. And she said the word serious quite a few times, the importance of us being serious. Dr. Cambon certainly says that a lot, the importance of black people being serious and trying to solve this problem. Thomas in New York, did you have commentary? Might be.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was a great interview. You know, one of the tragic events, you know, in American history. I thought she did a great job expressing why she doesn't vote. And I agree with her 100%. I thought that she was very good. I was impressed by the interviews. And, you know, I just feel so bad for them, what happened to them. You know, a system at its best. I did want to make a comment on Gus, I know you don't like to watch the videos, but did you see the video of the gentleman who was a psychiatrist who was helping the gentleman and got shot? She mentioned it.
I am familiar with that event. I did not watch the video, and I am not going to watch the video, but I am familiar with that incident.
Yeah, afterwards, the police officer comes out, and he tries to make it seem, you know, this is not about race. This isn't like the rest of them. And what caught me by surprise was the person that he was with was sitting on the ground, and the cop said that he was aiming for the other person, and it's like, but he was sitting down too, like, you know, I mean, it just doesn't add up, and I'm glad she mentioned that, because I think that the media and everyone is trying to spin that one, like, look, this one's different from the rest of them, you know, this was an actual accident, and I don't believe that at all. Did you get the email I sent you, Gus, at Micah Johnson's stepmother?
Yes, I did see that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was, when I saw that, I was, you know, like, wow, you know, I wasn't expecting that. And then it kind of made my, thinking that this was all, staged, even come up more because, you know, that he's getting a lot of white validation, you know, so unless that stopped, I don't know. But, you know, I just don't see that scenario playing out the way it did. After I saw that picture, it was like, I knew it. Something was wrong with this whole thing. Other than that, I hit my line, and thanks for having the show, man.
For sure, for sure. He mailed the report, looks like, or at least reported, Micah Xavier Johnson. This is the black male who is accused, the suspected shooter in Dallas with the five enforcement officials reportedly were killed, that his stepmother looks like she could be a white person, at least some of the reports. Yeah, something folks can check out at your leisure. See what you think about that, how that influences what you think about that whole situation. I know there was my comment that I was going to get in. I just was trying to cover as much as we could with the time that we have about those police shootings where she said that it seems that their lives matter, that people get really upset and something needs to be done about this immediately. And this is a problem that needs to be solved right now. And that's not the stance that we take with black people being harmed in the system of white supremacy. That it's not even when enforcement officials are shot and killed, because we pointed out just last week with Norm Stamper, white people have gone out and killed quite a few enforcement officials, and there was not this hue and cry, and we need to stop. Everyone needs to stop and address this. It seems that it only gets a substantial amount of attention when it's reported that a black person killed an enforcement officer. I do think that that is extremely important. And again, just because you just had a white person in between the Dallas shooting and the Baton Rouge shooting, you just had a white person in Michigan go and kill two bailiffs in a courtroom, no less. And this was someone who was looking at a lengthy sentence. I don't know if it was going to be life, but he was looking at many, many years behind prison, greater confinement for rape and sexual misconduct. He shot and killed two bailiffs, died in the process, and that disappeared almost immediately. Nobody even remembers his name. Nobody even talks about that anymore. I think that is also extremely important. And again, just the importance of the way that we use words and in the system of white supremacy. They can focus your attention here. They can focus your attention there. They can make this seem really important. They can minimize this. It is extremely important. And in my view, why it's so important. Dr. Welsing talked about this. Dick Gregory has talked about this. I haven't heard Mr. Fuller talk about it directly, but he does demonstrate paying attention to the news on a regular basis, locally, nationally, globally, is very important, just so that you can be more informed about things that are happening. That it just is invaluable within the system of white supremacy. Again, Mumia Abu-Jamal, outstanding illustration of this point. Someone who did this from greater confinement, death row for many years, and then just still being in a maximum security prison environment to still be super informed about things that are happening on this planet. Extremely important. One last point I did want to get in about Ramona Africa. If anybody else had things, they commentary that they wanted to share on that, feel free certainly to dial in. But one last thing that I did want to get in, something that I have heard Gus T. Renegade comment, remark about on a regular basis that she shared. Not just the serious thing. I've said that. I think Dr. Cambon has said that. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing has said that. But when people say, when they talk about fighting against racism and that you could be harmed, look what's happened to people, Asada Shakur, Minister Malcolm, Dr. King, many other black people who move, who try to do something about racism, white supremacy, and they were harmed. It is so monumentally important to keep in mind the whole reason that we need to solve this problem is that you have legions, millions, really billions of non-white people on this planet who are being harmed, who are not doing anything in an effort to counter racism. You see that every day. The incident that you're talking about in Florida, This was a non-white male victim of racism. He was not out peddling Mr. Fuller's books. He was not quoting speeches from Marcus Garvey, Dr. Campan, Assata Shakur. He was not waging some campaign to make sure that she's safe in Cuba. And he ends up getting shot. You see this every day. Walter Scott in South Carolina. He was not waging any campaigns to get the Confederate flag taken down. He was not trying to get Ben Tillman statues taken down. He was not talking about racism. You see this all the time. If I just follow the logic, if all I needed to do, if all non-white people, black people in particular, if all we needed to do was don't say anything about racism, don't fuss about this, don't bring up white supremacy, everything will be fine. If that's all we needed to do to be safe, we wouldn't have a problem. We could just cancel this show right now and go about our business, talk about anything else, what's going to be on television, what's going down at the Democratic National Convention. We could talk about anything else if that was going to keep us safe. Obviously, that is laughable. It is just not the case. And I'd super appreciate her making that point repeatedly. I said, woof, that does sound very familiar. Someone I know says that, makes that point often. And that's one that needs to be brought up, because I do hear that from other victims of racism on a pretty regular basis. That, you know, if we try to do something about racism, white supremacy, racist man, racist woman, racist child, they, you know, might harm us. That could happen regardless, is happening regardless, which is should be even more motivation for us doing the work to solve this problem immediately. That's it.
I got to have one more thing. It's very odd that we had a cop shot in Kansas City, and nothing on the news really about it. It's like that disappeared, and the suspect that they caught and showed the two black males, and they were looking for two other black males. So I just thought that was really odd, because that happened the week of the Republican convention, and no one harped on it. And I just thought that was extremely perfect timing for them to keep up their war on police thing, and they never mentioned it at all. I just thought it was odd.
For sure. Again, that is the power in the system of white supremacy. They can play things up when they want to. They can minimize when they want to. Just goes according to what they think is important right now, what they want people to be focused on, paying attention to. We certainly will have time during the compensatory call-in this weekend to check in about what happened in Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. I did think that was profound, the timing of having Ramona Africa here at this point, because I've been trying to get her on the program earlier, but to have her on at this moment where she's calling us live from Philadelphia at the exact moment that the Democratic National Convention is taking place. And I think, unless I have misinterpreted things, I think while she was here, former Attorney General Eric Holder was speaking at the DNC. I could be incorrect. I have to double check. Obviously, I'm not watching it. But once we get off the air, I'll double check to see if that is indeed true. But that notwithstanding, we will have an opportunity to check in this weekend after everything has concluded in Philadelphia with that and people's perspective, if anything has stood out about the system of white supremacy and what has gone down there. I at least at minimum, I think it is profound for Eric Holder to be speaking there. I know Michelle Obama, First Lady, was the keynote speaker last night. Everyone talked about, you know, she gave an epic speech and, you know, it was such a great job and helping Hillary Clinton out. Just something about that struck me as a bit odd in a system of white supremacy to have Michelle Obama and now Eric Holder to have them as the help for suspected white supremacist Hillary Clinton in a week where the Democratic Party and her specifically are taking such a badgering for all of these allegations of corruption and them not doing things in a just manner in the whole election process and the emails being leaked and what have you, to have black people come out on cue to save the day and help her get to the White House. Wow. That is the system of white supremacy. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they got, they get in? We will be back. Make sure I get this in for sure. We'll be here tomorrow. Pam, I'm sure she will have a word to say about what's happened at the DNC, as well as some of the other events that have been taking place this summer. Co-author of Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, the Interracial Con Game, the Beauty Con Game, Trojan Horse, Death of a Dark Nation. She also manages the RacismWS.com website. Racism is White Supremacy website. You can check it out. She'll be here tomorrow, give some of her views on what has taken place, as I said, this summer, the DNC, the shootings, some suggestions on things that we can and should be doing to counter racism. That'll be tomorrow, same broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Certainly we'll be here this Thursday, Workplace Racism, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I think we'll be on the next 4 consecutive days. I think we'll be on every day until Sunday, at least. Same time, every day, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The only exception, obviously, the Saturday compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Tune in. Looking forward to hearing from folks at the end of the week. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they get in? Doesn't have to necessarily be related to what we heard from Ramona Africa. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they touched on before we conclude? Folks are satisfied. I'll assume folks are set.
Yep.
I'll assume folks are satisfied for the day. I can say I won't say pestered, but folks did lobby. Listeners lobbied well. I should give the appreciation. I requested the video, high quality video, no less. I was snobbish about it for The Purge election year. That's the latest installment in the film franchise. This film franchise is made in the neighborhood of $300 million with their three films that are about this one night where you can go out and kill as many people as you like. I was encouraged to do a program talking about these films and the significance within the context of white supremacy, the timing of when these films have been released, what messages this film franchise is communicating. Obviously, well, because they've done three of them in pretty short succession, and they've been extremely, financially speaking, they have done extremely well at the box office. I am going to see if we can make that happen. I'll give the update to see if we can have a guest on to kind of put all of these in context. What messages, but I have seen the latest one. It's pretty explicit. They have the white power symbols and all that. They make it pretty plain what they're talking about. I probably can share if folks are interested in seeing that. That was one. Speaking of films, the memory, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, she recommended Sycamore Row, which is a book by John Grisham. This is a white male author. He wrote A Time to Kill, which I'm sure many more folks are familiar with because they made a movie out of that book, A Time to Kill, with Samuel L. Jackson and Sandra Bullock. And it's quite a few other big name actors. Kevin Spacey are in A Time to Kill, which came out about 20 years ago, where the black male, his daughter, is raped and terrorized by two white supremacists. And he resorts to counter violence and he kills them. And then he gets a white attorney, Matthew McConaughey, to defend him for this murder that he commits, counter violence that he commits. But John Grisham did that book. He also did Sycamore Row. Dr. Welsing recommended this book. And she talked about it on the program. I posted it. She talked about this is back 2013. She talked about this book. And she even said her sister, I was itching to call her sister to see if it was Lauren Cress Love, because she had more than one sister, but to see if it was Lauren Cress Love, who she said also raved about this book, because we could get her back on the program to talk about it. But Sycamore Row, the basic plot of the book is an individual classified as white. He commits suicide. He hangs himself, no less. He has a lot of money. He has a will that's already typed up with the lawyers, it's official and everything. Just before he commits suicide, he writes a new will that is legal. He writes a brand new will where he basically leaves everything to his black maid, the help again, leaves everything to her. And the plot of the book is the court wrangling and all of that as this white attorney. And it's the same guy, no less. It's Jake Brigance, the character from A Time to Kill. He is representing this black female to get this money for her that this white man has left her. And this becomes, God, this is the same town, by the way, where A Time to Kill took place, right? So in Mississippi. So the whole town is trying to figure out, why did this white man, why did he commit suicide? Why did he leave all of this? And I mean, it's like millions. Why did he leave all this money to this nigger woman? And were they doing something sexual? That's the plot of the book, and it just goes from there. And it's John Grisham's, most of his books, they're court cases, right? He was a former attorney, so a lot of his books, they are court fictions. But that's what this book is about, and Dr. Welsing was raving about this, like, yeah, you should check it out. She talked about it on the program. I remembered it was like, oh, we should do that for the book club, since that was something Dr. Welsing and Kurt, reading is more important than watching television. She encouraged it. I pulled back because John Grisham, he did an interview some time ago where he talked about being classified as white. He said that racism is in his DNA. And he explained and he talked about how that is manifested in the books that he writes. He was talking about A Time to Kill. I looked at some of the other books that he's written, because quite a few of the books that he's written, they deal with racism, white supremacy, in some way, shape, or form. It's not just A Time to Kill and Sycamore Row. He has another book called The Chamber. They also made this into a movie, which you might want to check out if you have, you know, the time, the energy. The Chamber is about a white supremacist, a Klan member, no less, in Mississippi. He bombs a white office, kills two white children, injures a white man. This is a white person who had been doing work for the what they call civil rights movement and trying to help black people. So he kills these two white children. They put him, they convict him, and he's going to get the gas chamber. That's why it's called The Chamber. He's going to get the death penalty. And so this whole book is about this white man trying to get this white supremacist, murdering white supremacist, off of death row. And it just follows the case and what he's trying to do to get him off of death row. The movie is interesting. I haven't read the book, but I have seen the movie. There is an interesting aspect even with that, where I see some symbolism in terms of patterns that come through in some of his writings. The white man who is the attorney trying to get this white supremacist so he doesn't get killed, trying to make sure that he doesn't get the death penalty, he is aided by a black female who's played by Layla Rashan. If people remember her, she was really popular in the 1980s. She was in quite a few films, Boomerang, if memory serves, and quite a few others. But she is like helping him in this case, trying to get information and what have you, again, to get this racist white supremacist so that he doesn't die. And at one point, a white person asks this white attorney, "Are you sleeping with her?" That pops up at one point and continues, but it is a rather interesting view if you are so inclined to check it out. Again, it's called The Chamber. Actually, you can do either. You can read it or you can watch the film, or you can do both. And I think the book is even short enough. It might be a project, because I was talking about ways that you can get your, if you have children, get them into reading. This might be a way because you could watch this or you could read the book. And then you can watch the movie together and you can compare, contrast. It's not that long. I know sometimes people, if you have children, and they don't want to read a book that's super, super long. This one is not. I think you could probably finish this one up before school starts back up at the end of August, beginning of September. It's not super long. The Chamber. So this is also by John Grisham. I think he even has I know he has another one. I'm just struggling trying to remember the name of the book, and I have it. I'm going to see if I can find it really quick. I can give you the name of that one, and I can give you the short synopsis. But this is The Racketeer. That's the name of it, The Racketeer. This also is about racism, white supremacy, and it is a black male is in prison. That's how it starts. He's in greater confinement, and the story is you finding out what he did to get in greater confinement, but it's talking pretty explicitly about racism, white supremacy throughout, and him having to deal with racism. You get, like, at the very beginning, they're explaining that racism, white supremacy has contributed to why he's in greater confinement in the first place. He's also an attorney. As I said, all of John Grisham's books, they're related to racism, white supremacy in some way, shape, or form. But that is a pattern. I don't read a lot of fiction. I don't read fiction really at all. Most of the books I read, they're nonfiction. And I certainly have never been a John Grisham fan. I really only knew him from A Time to Kill. I didn't read the book. I just saw the film. But Dr. Welsing said that, and then I think one of our listeners mentioned The Racketeer. And after that, that was when I started going to look to see if he does talk about racism. In quite a few of his books, he does. So check that one out, The Chamber. It's fascinating. If you watch the film, you have a thought or two you would like to share, feel free to chime in. You can email me untiljustice@gmail.com. You can share it on the Facebook page, Twitter, whatever the case may be. And again, if you're looking for things, material for your children to read, that might be one. You could read the book and then watch the film. Final comment I want to make sure I got in. We did the program earlier this month where Dr. Kamal Kambandi gave some of his reflections on Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. At the beginning of the program, I played a clip that was about 2 minutes. It was very brief, where a black female, she confronted a suspected racist in Oklahoma. This was after Kevin Durant decided he was going to go play for the Golden State Warriors. And they were doing the same thing when they get upset about a black person, particularly if it's an athlete and they switch, go to a different team, what have you, and they're upset and he's a traitor. We hate him. We're going to burn his jersey and all this other stuff. And this black female, she confronted him and said, you know, you shouldn't be doing all that. This is, you know, a black male. He decided to do what he wanted to take his talents and his career and go someplace else. He invested 9 years being here and making this town relevant and making this basketball team relevant. And you should appreciate him. And, you know, it's incorrect what you're doing. I'm paraphrasing, but that's about the gist of what she said, that it's wrong what you're doing. It's incorrect for you to just be out here disparaging and talking bad about this black male. And I said, and I still say, act of black self-respect. In my view, anytime that a black person, when you recognize that a black person is being harmed, that a suspected racist is doing something incorrect, and particularly if they're doing something incorrect targeting a black person directly, indirectly, even if that black person is not there to physically experience it, and you choose to confront that act of incorrectness, that act of white supremacy, racism, in my view, that's black self-respect. That's what we should be doing, trying to solve this problem and making an effort to confront that regularly, as often as we possibly can when we choose to do so. We had a listener who wrote in, and they voiced some concern that me taking that stance and saying that this, in my view, is an act of black self-respect, that there is something incorrect about that, or that I should not have said that. And they said that, I'm paraphrasing, but they said that we should be careful about black males being encouraging a black female to be a feminist when it is convenient for us being black males, that we should be cautious about that. And I questioned the comment, the response, because I didn't understand. I did not label what this black female did as an act of feminism. I did not label her a feminist. What I said then, what I say now, is that it is an act of black self-respect anytime a black person, male or female, or makes a decision for themselves that I think what this individual is doing is incorrect. It could be racism, and I'm going to confront this individual. I'm going to confront this right now in whatever way that I choose. I think that's an act of black self-respect. That's what I said then. That's what I say now. If there's anything incorrect about that, please point that out. If there is a problem with that, please point that out. The other aspect of what the person put forward was that black males, I presumably like myself, would say that it's great or would endorse a black female being a feminist, even though that's not what I said, when it's convenient for us. But we would not defend, protect a black female if she was attacked by a white person. This black female wasn't attacked. They have video of the footage. I reposted it on the Facebook page. She was not attacked. There was no violence. The white individual, suspected racist, he said what he said. This black female, she said what she said, and then she departed. There was no violence. There was no striking, hitting, anything like that. They exchanged words. It was like 2 minutes, and then she departed. I will say, under the system of white supremacy, and I think I've taken this stance consistently, you shouldn't have an expectation that a black male is going to be able to protect, defend any black female under the system of white supremacy. In my view, it is simply not logical, and beyond that, it's self-evident. Black males don't even have the ability to protect ourselves. That also is logical if there is a system of white supremacy. And unfortunately, it's also very daily self-evident. If we could protect ourselves, we would not have all of this protesting and marching and crying about Tamir Rice and Michael Brown and Eric Garner, insert name. It just goes on and on and on. That is evident. You should not depend on any other victim of white supremacy to protect and defend you. That simply does not make logical sense. And that is the stance that I've had and talked about, articulated on this program repeatedly throughout the years. It does not mean that you can't make an effort, that you can't try, but it's simply not logical to even have that in mind, that I can defend this victim of white supremacy while I am still on the slave ship myself. If I could do that, I would start, what do they say, charity begins at home. If I could do that, I would start with me, protecting, defending me. And I have not seen where any victim of white supremacy is successfully able to do that. If I am in error, please step forward and set gut straight. If I'm not speaking logically, if what I'm saying doesn't make sense, step forward and set me straight. I will also make sure that I get in. I do think that it's important, even if we do not agree, if we have different views, which certainly is going to be the case. No surprise there. We should make an effort to correctly attribute statements to other individuals, particularly if they're non-white people, victims of racism. I think it should apply across the board. But certainly if we're going to talk about another victim of white supremacy and we have a difference of opinion that, you know, folks think is important enough that it needs to be voiced or addressed, then let's make sure that we are not attributing any statements or what have you, terminology that the person actually did not use. With that, we will wrap things up. Thanks, everyone, for chiming in. If you have comments, gripes, complaints, guest suggestions, feel free to drop an email. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. We're also on Stitcher @UntilJustice. You can get the archives at iTunes, Stitcher.com, Blueberry. They are widely available. They're at the Black Talk Radio Network. If you have problems finding anything in the archives, some of our previous episodes, let me know, and I will do my best to hook you up. With that, I again encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. I know it is warm, and folks are out frolicking, going to the beach, and whatever else folks do in the summertime. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We're already being attacked under the system of white supremacy. You do not want to be intoxicated where anything is impairing your ability to think, speak, act, manage your emotions in the best possible manner. We want to be able to make phenomenal decisions so that we can keep ourselves as safe as possible. Certainly, if you are in an automobile, driver, passenger, even if you're a pedestrian, you do not want to be intoxicated. You never know when it will be Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw pulling up behind you. They can make a lot of trouble for us with or without a badge, including taking our lives. You do not want to make their job any easier by being intoxicated so that they can further justify any level of terrorism brutality that they choose to mete out. Buckle up every time you're in the vehicle. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That said, thanks for tuning in. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.